world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. My guest is Katrin Ganswit, head of finance research for the German environment group Urgewald. And we were talking about their new big list of companies investing in climate chaos. What about the big investment hub in London? Are the European investors part of this climate killing game that you report on?
Yeah, of course they are. You saw more and more progressive coal exclusion policies in Europe. You could definitely see there is a movement. We also see first oil and gas policies slowly emerging. Here the insurance industry has really been at the front of everything. But especially when it comes to oil and gas, with a focus on that, there's hardly any good policy out there. And as you said, the big investment hub London is still within Europe number one. So you say, as you rightly said, 64% of all investments coming from U.S. companies, but the second biggest share is actually coming from Europe, and within Europe it's coming from the U.K., so basically from London. And number one here is Legal & General from London, who is the biggest investor in the U.K. But if you look at whole Europe, the biggest investor is actually, again, a pension fund, the pension fund of Norway. The pension fund of Norway also did a big coal divestment. They didn't capture the full coal industry, but at least this was really impactful also for other investors to go ahead after, especially the Nordic investors. But Norway's pension fund so far has no intention to move out of oil and gas, and therefore they're still big in the game. They're the with almost $60 billion U.S. dollar, they're Europe's biggest fossil fuel investor.
Katrin, tell us more about the Investing in Climate Chaos website and how to use it.
Yeah, of course. So at investinginclimatechaos.org, you can obviously first see a bit of an overview. What are the main messages we want to bring across? Some nice graphs to make it easier to digest. But then really the centerpiece of our website is our data research mask, where you can look for any individual company or investor in the scope of our research. You can look only at oil and gas, where the information is derived from our own data from the Global Oil and Gas Exit List. You can as well just look at coal, where the data is derived from our own Global Coal Exit List. So this is our own databases where this is coming from. But you can also, for example, look up all investors in oil and gas stemming from the U.S. if you want. You can filter by country, by region, yeah, by type of investment. So you can really look up whatever you find interesting. And, of course, you have an extensive methodology which explains everything you need to know and our contact details in case you even want to know more.
I think this is a big breakthrough because so much of this information was hidden. There are private contracts between businesses and the public doesn't need to know, but the public really does need to know if we're going to be getting a whole lot more gas and oil down the pipeline. What brought this project going and who else is helping you with it?
So what brought this project going was, first of all, that we in the past just looked at the coal industry and now we wanted to have the full picture and really talk about all fossil fuels. We have lots of, there's a network of NGOs who's working on finance, not only on banks, with our sister publication, Banking on Climate Chaos, the draft a week earlier, but also on investors, especially on pension funds, but also on specific asset managers. So all these people really liked our coal data and wanted to work with it. So we wanted to bring more information out there on oil and gas investments as well for other parts of the network to just look up whatever they want to know. We are always sending out tables for specific countries, specific campaigns, so whoever, which part ever of the civil society who wants to work on finance, we always provide them with the information we have. But apart from that, we also wanted to have something which everybody can just easily look up without waiting for us. So really, we have 24 co-publishers for this publication, and their wish and need to have this data. But the research we didn't do alone. As first of all, as said, We have our global oil and gas exit list and our global coal exit list as basic resources for the data, and bringing these industry lists into life was just doable because of a network of NGOs which supported us anyway. On the other hand, we're looking at the financing side. So the financial data is basically drawn from financial commercial databases, which is usually used by the finance industry. So we turn around the use of this finance database and use it for our own purpose. And because accessing this database is complicated and super expensive, we do that together with Profundo, which is a not-for-profit company in the Netherlands. Yeah, last but not least, there's another important NGO partner, which is called Reclaim Finance, and they show the other side of the story. While we show the numbers, they show the policies of the investors we are ranking in our database. And if you look up an investor in our database, for example, Vanguard or BlackRock, you can also find a direct link to their oil, gas, and coal policy tools, and you can see how the policies of these investors are ranked, and you also find a direct link to their own publications.
I'm sorry, I missed the name of the group that has these policy recommendations.
This is Reclaim Finance.
Reclaim Finance.
So this is basically the counterpart to our data, is their policy analysis, and that's why we refer to each other. We do the finance data and they do the policy analysis, and we do a bit both, of course, but we try to split up specialties.
Catherine, as we wrap up here, what are the next steps for you and for Urgewald?
I mean, the next direct step concerning research is going to be, we are already researching for the annual updates of our global coal exit list and our global oil and gas exit list, so that we have new industry numbers so that we can also do new and fresh finance research. And the next planned research is a bank's research on coal, on the whole coal industry and on all banks on the planet. Yeah, and we will talk and discuss more with our colleagues from the Rainforest Action Network on how we can do the next year's Banking on Climate Chaos and Investing in Climate Chaos studies even better and even more useful for civil society.
From Germany, we've been speaking with financial investigator Catherine Ganswit from the environment group Urgewald. Catherine is part of a whole team of nonprofit groups developing a huge file of over 6,000 companies financing fossil fuel expansion around the world. Get access to all of that at www.investinginclimatechaos.org. Check out my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org for more links to follow up. Catherine, thank you for shining a light on these real-time climate profiteers.
Thank you for the invitation, and thanks for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
During extreme heat in New York City, black Americans die at twice the rate of whites. That is just the tip of climate injustice in the United States, and climate is just part of pollution hitting African Americans. As climate change ramps up the heat, storms, and floods, it puts a spotlight on systemic racism in America. Can it change? Psychologist Dr. Derek Sabree Jr. can trace his family roots back to slavery. Now this clinical psychologist is examining the ways abusive nature has become a vehicle for continuing oppression. Derek is a core faculty member at Michigan School of Psychology. He also practices eco-psychology. From Ann Arbor, Michigan, Derek Sabree, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, for having me.
Look, as a privileged white guy in Canada, I feel highly unqualified to talk about nature and the black experience, so I'm glad you're here. My guess from history is that separation during the mass movement from the South on the plantations to the North, indoors to factories, do you think there was a loss of connection to nature for many descendants of slaves in America?
Yes, I do. There's definitely a lot of history when we really take a look in which the environment has been a vehicle for racial violence, terror as well, you know, considering advances of things like lynching, you know, and how nature has been a part of that process, thinking of trees, I mean, even thinking of the idea of going into the wilderness, there's a connotation of, well, being in the wilderness means, you know, there is potentially no protection from racial attacks that, you know, might have not necessarily more protection in an area that's populated more heavily, but there is at least the potential social indication of, okay, there's other people around, whereas, yeah, being outdoors, there is that potential threat.
So how has the environment and nature become a vehicle for the oppression of Black people, in your view?
Well, thinking of just many structural and systemic racism, just experiences with things like redlining, for instance. So when we talk about redlining, you know, we're looking at the systemic denial of housing, residential placements to Black Americans, and how when we look at redlining, we also see those same areas that have been redlined tend to have less biodiversity, less green space, higher rates of pollution, air pollution, water pollution. And so we see the policy that was enacted with redlining has also caused, you know, environmental changes in these areas where, if you look at more affluent areas, taking Michigan, for instance, like the Metro Detroit area, there tends to be less green space within Detroit proper, whereas if you go just outside of Detroit to the suburbs, it really shifts into like a night and day kind of change there. So that just being one of the examples of how we see that racial disparity showing up in these environmental impacts.
And your family came north in that great migration by African Americans, and I wonder, does that foreshadow the coming climate migrations as parts of America become unlivable with continuing climate change? Or I guess we've already seen that to a degree with New Orleans after Katrina.
Right. So typically when we see these large disasters, taking wildfires out west, for instance, you do start to see people making shifts, moving. The trick with that is who has the resources, the support to actually make those moves. And typically it's not African-Americans, Black Americans, descendants of slavery there. It's typically folks who have more resources, typically more white Americans, European Americans, that when it comes down to, okay, I need to leave because this area is the unsafe, or maybe I just need to exit this area because I don't have any way to stay here anymore. Maybe I can go stay with a relative or stay with somebody else, whereas typically Black Americans don't have that option. And that's something we saw with Katrina a lot, is a lot of folks, the residents who were continuing to live through that were folks who didn't have anywhere else to go.
In a presentation for mental health professionals, you explained three stages of domination: slavery, followed by segregation, and then mass incarceration. Derek, did this come into your own life as you were growing up?
Yeah, I mean, in ways. So my father has been in and out of prison. So, I mean, really at an early age, being confronted with the engine of mass incarceration there. And so, you know, really seeing how that impacts families, how that impacts really communities when you have these shifts and these disruptions and home in these ways because of that, you know, the school to prison pipeline or some other avenue of structural inequity, that when that happens, then you're seeing that affect multiple generations, and it takes families and sometimes. And you're thinking about the advent of slavery, of Jim Crow, all the way into mass incarceration, that's not something that people can shift in a lifetime by themselves.
Yes, you talk about shadow slavery. What do you mean by that?
So there's the element of when we're talking about the shadow side of that, is it still continues in different ways. Maybe think of wage slavery, where, you know, often Black American folks work for gig economies, which you typically have to keep working in that frame if you want to survive. It's not about thriving in that space. And then just thinking, really, slavery itself has shifted over time. And part of that is the mass incarceration engine. So now having a captive audience, and that captive audience essentially has to be there. There is no other choice with that. There's a movie that came out a couple of years ago. It's called Alice, and it's in reference, you know, that Alice in Wonderland style. But it was talking about a woman who, a Black American woman who was living on a plantation. And so for most of the movie, you don't know what's really happening around there. She actually managed to get off the plantation. And it turns out she's in the 1960s, 1970s. But there's still these kind of secret shadow plantations that still exist. And so it was really an allegory to say, you know, there's this Alice in Wonderland effect of people don't really notice that this is here, but it was still there. And so we still see those different manifestations of not necessarily slavery in the proper sense, but this sense of oppression, a sense of servitude, and, okay, do I have ownership over this other individual?
So in your professional life, you also practice and train people in eco-psychology. What is that really?
So eco-psychology, what we're looking at is the relationship between people and elements of the environment, of nature. So that includes a lot of different aspects. There's the emphasis of animal-assisted psychotherapy, and so that being part of that as well. Equine psychotherapy as well, but then also getting into interactions with natural landscapes. So green therapy pieces of horticultural therapy, aquatic therapies that focus on interactions with, you know, bodies of water and so forth. So as time goes on, we see more of the impact of the importance of having a relationship with your environment. We know on the other side of it, like when your environment is unhealthy, then you're also going to be unhealthy. You know, more research continues to come out about dementia risk and pollution. The higher amounts of air pollution you have, the higher the rates of dementia is going to go up. And so seeing kind of these relational aspects of what happens in our environment ultimately affects us on multiple levels. Right? And so that's really eco-psychology is looking at, okay, there's an interdependent relationship between us and the natural world. You know, we cannot separate ourselves from it because it is a part of us too. And when we tend to, it causes issues for us and it causes issues for the environment.
Some misinformed white people think that those with African appearance can withstand the heat better. But we learn from studies that, as I mentioned, African Americans are more likely to die during extreme heat waves. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's several parts to that. One of them is thinking about the prevalence of things like asthma, high blood pressure, chronic health conditions within Black American communities, for instance. And so there's already that pre-existing racial disparity there. We saw that a lot with COVID, in that we had probably at least three times the national average of deaths in like just Detroit alone related to COVID. And that was because of asthma. You know, the high asthma rates, was already a pre-existing condition there. And there tends to be a lot of air pollution within Detroit because of environmental racism. And so there's already a pre-existing, it's something that's ripe for the picking, unfortunately. And so when it comes to heat, that shows up again. So asthma and heat don't mix well. Folks who tend to have asthma and get into extreme heat usually can't breathe very well. Same thing with high blood pressure. Typically, blood pressure medication is heat sensitive and sun sensitive. So, because it tends to make folks have a harder time regulating body temperature and so forth. So, if that is a part of the mix too, then it starts to create this, you know, really vulnerability there. And then also just being a displaced person, so homeless and so forth. You have less protection from the heat. You don't have, you know, you don't have a house for that. And then folks who might have a house, it might not be, the infrastructure might not be up to par for them to actually deal with the extreme heat even in their own home.
Are there particular steps that could help more African Americans as the climate shifts?
Yes. You know, I'm a proponent of, you know, social justice and eco-justice environmental justice being linked together. And so a part of that is really thinking about the push for reparative justice, particularly with like Black American, American descendants of the slavery community, and how the push for policy change, reparations, for the importance of offsetting those structural and systemic elements that are contributing to these disparities, and that also being a way to address issues of climate, issues of environmental injustice. If communities who typically are faced with these challenges have more resources for themselves to deal with them, that tends to benefit all of us.
We know from studies that African Americans are more distrustful of the medical system, at least some people, and maybe secretly testing plutonium on Black Americans, which really happened, could be one reason why. Dr. Derek Seabree, do you think that this extends to less trust of climate scientists as well, as part of maybe a white establishment?
Yeah, I think part of that leads to that especially. I think there's a general distrust of, I would say, predominantly white institutions. And so, you know, those climate scientists, they're typically coming from predominantly white institutions. And I think a lot of the time, there's not a focus on, okay, what is the contextual element here of how does this affect your community? How does this affect you? And how can we help you? I think when folks hear a lot of news about this is what's going to happen with the climate, and there's no way to say, okay, and this is what we can do about it, people tend to shut down. Or if there's not a personal element there of like, okay, this is how it's going to impact you and is maybe what we can do, folks think, well, what's the point, right? And so then you get some of that fatalism, that kind of climate doom showing up of like, well, that's just going to happen, so what are we going to do about it?
You direct a program to train psychologists in Michigan. Are new psychologists learning about these complicated relations between race history and climate injustice? Are they ready to deal with that in patients?
I would say not fully. There's a push, you know, within the American Psychological Association and many like state and territorial associations to promote more of that training. As an educator myself in a graduate program here at the Michigan School of Psychology, I'm one of the few in the country who, I mean, integrates it in the curriculum at this point. Like, there's not even training programs that have really popped up yet. So, yeah, there's definitely still the need for that gap, to close that gap.
It sounds like there's a lot of work to do. Talk to us about the social justice organizations around Detroit that you worked with.
Well, so in the past, working with just various organizations, so there's a called the CARES organization that's centered out of Detroit. I work with some individuals who have represented them while we've gone to Capitol Hill to advocate for policy change, legislature on, hey, how do we promote people having more access to funding for climate change mitigation efforts or, you know, different efforts for training and so forth. And then also working with just different organizations within the state, so the Michigan Psychological Association, helping them develop and know who to talk to in terms of, okay, what organizations are out there that we're maybe going to want to partner with as psychologists. And then also working with the American Descendants of Slavery Advocacy Foundation and promoting the importance of how do we address climate change specifically for, you know, the American Descendants of Slavery community. Right? Like, we have to contextualize these pieces of how are these things going to continue to show up, because it is going to continue to evolve.
Suppose we become more aware of climate injustice and our responsibility for it. Do you have suggestions about how our listeners can learn more about it?
Yeah, I would say, you know, one of the interesting parts now is there's definitely getting to be more mainstream coverage of climate change, the impacts of it, and so forth. What I would say is, you know, really just reaching out to your local community, finding groups in the local community that are already engaged in this work. This is definitely a work where everybody can can play a part, and everybody really essentially needs to play a part. And so I think people understand that it's not about what's happening across the world, it's about what's happening in your backyard. And really, how is it happening in your backyard? Because it's already showing up. It's just a matter of being able, like you said, being able to notice that. You know, often, so like the White House here in the United States just recently approved for an Office of Environmental Justice, you know, so now federal bodies have to essentially report on, okay, what is their agenda about addressing environmental justice issues, you know, from every departmental standpoint. That's a huge shift from what it's been in the past. So there's definitely a full momentum starting to build up, but it is also about helping people understand. It's not about trying to look at the national level and say, okay, how do I support that? It's just tuning in and how do you support the community around you? Like here in Detroit, we have excessive flooding. You know, the city of Detroit itself has flooded out probably at least two times within the last 6 years. And so that's something that hasn't really happened in over 100 years. So, you know, these are things that are showing up specifically for communities. I remember a while back finding a website. There's several websites out there that actually will track and calculate what is the impact of climate change, like, on your house. Like, how is it going to impact your property values? Things like that. Like, I think that's how you start to help people understand, is giving them that context of this is going to impact your day-to-day in these ways. And people need avenues for support. So community organizations that are already engaged in this are helpful because it helps people not feel alone as they're faced with something that seems, you know, just so impassable and daunting.
From the Michigan School of Psychology, we've been speaking with Dr. Derek Sabree, Jr. You can find links to learn more in my weekly show blog published at ecoshock.org. Derek, thank you for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Thank you for listening and for your support to keep on going with hot news in a troubled world.
But first to Spain, which is dealing with an unprecedented heat wave for this time of the year. Many places have already been hit by an unseasonally dry winter. Spanish forecasters expect this heat wave to peak today and into...
It feels like a hot summer, but it's just the end of April. The thermometer has touched 39 degrees Celsius in Córdoba, an unprecedented level that worries many residents.
In August, we've been getting up to 50 degrees. What is going to be this year, 60?
Bangladesh.
Well, no respite, really. There's no rain. The monsoon season officially started in the middle of this month, April, and there's no sight of rain except for a little bit of rain in the northeast of the country. Other than that, it's been dry heat wave all across the country for the last 2 weeks. Temperature rising, as you just mentioned, over 40 degrees in some parts of the country. The capital city itself experienced 41.1 on last Sunday, which was one of the highest since almost 60 years now. This is a month of Ramadan. In a Muslim-majority country, most people are fasting from dusk to dawn, and it's become very challenging, particularly for the working people, those working as rickshaw pullers, day laborers, and in the industries, also people living in the slum with tin roofs. A lot of internal migration due to the impact of climate. People from coastal areas migrate to the urban areas. That's a major challenge in the urban city like Dhaka, which has grown since 1980s. Used to be 17% greeneries. Now it has barely 2% greeneries in the city. A lot of it is man-made intervention. A lot of the canals and the wetlands are grabbed by land grabbers. Four rivers surrounding the city are narrowed. They're also grabbed by land.
But the real heat actually has been around for a bit longer and a bit further east in, for example, Takin, Thailand. Either Friday or on Saturday, I think it's probably been Saturday, 45.4, first time it's ever been recorded in the country. And it's not just Thailand, it's true in Myanmar as well. It's also been reported this morning, as of yesterday, that Laos has reported its highest ever temperature, 42.7, an all-time national record. So this part of Asia has been extremely extremely hot, and that spread across into China. Now, last year, China had virtually no significant rain, so there was a drought problem.
Thailand is facing unprecedented levels of heat. This comes amid the country battling a drastic increase in respiratory problems triggered by a spike in air pollution.